Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome back to our Coastal Command's Cold War series. Last chapter we learnt what it was like to fly in the old Growler. In this chapter we're looking to better understand the aircraft and in particular the airframe Whiskey Romeo 963. To help us we have Richard Woods from the Shackleton Preservation Trust. Rich, welcome to Extended.
Thank you Peter, I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much for your time, because I know it's a really, really busy time for you, and we'll come back to why that is in a moment. But before we talk about the Shackleton, how did you get into aviation? Where does aviation come in your blood?
I tried joining the RAF out of school. I got this burning desire to fly an aircraft for a living, but unfortunately, circumstances conspired against me, and my eyesight wasn't sufficient to be aircrew. So I decided that I'd still like to do something engineering. So I went off and joined the army. I was a Royal Engineer for nearly 10 years. But in the meantime, I was still looking at aircraft and preservation and things like that. So trying to satisfy myself, I decided I'd get a flight in an old Douglas Dakota DC-3. And at the time, this being about 98, 99, the one place that you could get a flight fairly regularly from was Air Atlantique Classic Flight at Coventry Airport. So off I toddled down to Coventry Airport, proffered them some cash to go in the DC-3. The DC-3 promptly had other ideas and broke, leaving me in Coventry with not a lot to do but to waste a few hours while they tried to fix it or rebook my flight. So I spent a little bit of time looking around Coventry Airport and the rest of the collection that Air Atlantique was putting together, and stumbled across a bunch of chaps that were looking after a decidedly faded-looking Avro Shackleton. Big tail number 6-3 on it. It was in blue back then. It was airborne early warning colours. It faded away. It had been there since 1991. I got roped into holding spanners and various parts of airframe for them while they were doing whatever they were doing on it. And then somebody came over and said, "Hey, your Dakota's fixed. Do you want to go for your flight?" And I was trying to persuade the guy, "Give me another minute, wait another minute, wait another minute." And I had to make a decision whether I wanted to go flying or whether I wanted to continue helping the guys with the Shackleton. So I decided I'd go for my DC-3 flight, seeing as I paid for the thing. But all the way through it, I kept looking down at the shack and thinking, that was fun. So I came back the next week, and then the next week, and then the week after that, and the week after that, and the weeks turned into months, the months turned into years, and I never really went home. So I've been looking after the shack for quite a while now.
Yeah, I've heard you've invested a fair number of hours into her. But tell us how the Preservation Trust came about then. Where does that come from, and how did that airframe come into being?
Basically, at the end of the Shackleton life in 1991, the four airframes that were deemed to have sufficient life left on them were put up for sale by the Ministry of Defence, and they went through Sotheby's on the 3rd of July 1991. There was a group put together called the Shackleton Preservation Trust. It was headed up by the Scottish politician David Littlegranger, and he bid successfully for two aircraft. He managed to get WR963 and WR790. The other two aircraft were sold to a Cypriot collector, and they're still out on Cyprus. They're at Paphos. 790 was returned to the skies, unfortunately not in UK skies. She could only fly in the States due to various involvement by the CAA and British Aerospace. And 63 was used as a parts source for a number of years before the Shackleton Preservation Trust was revived again with Squadron Leader John Cubley and some friends of his who set about restoring 963 to the condition that she enjoys today, or enjoyed before we started moving us to Yorkshire.
Yeah.
So that was where the Preservation Trust came about, in fact.
So how does a trust go about setting itself up to look after an aircraft like that? How do you keep, or how did you keep and are going to keep 963 running and operating? Tell us a bit about the trust.
Well, the trust itself, the Shackleton Preservation Trust, it came effectively to an end about 5-6 years ago. It was rebadged because the Charities Commission believed that we didn't offer significant charitable benefit in that we were looking after one aircraft, it was static and it didn't fly. So we rebranded as the Shackleton Aviation Group. So we're a CIC now, not a charity as such.
Okay.
But basically, the trust was set up with the intention to return either as Shackleton or another historical Coastal Command aircraft to the skies in the UK, or assist any other group that was involved in Coastal Command or the preservation of Coastal Command aircraft, which leads into the work that we've done in helping preserve Nimrod XV-232, which is the partner aircraft down at Coventry and run by another group after Classic Flight packed up a few years ago. But the trust was comprised of several people. David Lilgranger, the politician, he basically engaged the services of Air Atlantique Classic Flight to look after both the Shackletons. They looked after both Shackletons up until about 1996-97, when John Cubbley and the ex-Shack air crew and ground crew took over. They continued looking after 790 in the States until its retirement in 2008. After that, when John took over, he engaged other people who looked after the Shackleton both in its service period and who'd done work on Shackleton's post-service, because there's various engineers out that have touched on Griffin engines. A lot of the systems are the same in the stuff that you find within, say, Lancaster. There's a lot of crossover between Lincoln and Shackleton. So the pool of expertise at the time was quite wide. Coventry Airport at the Air Atlantique, they'd just taken the rebuild of the Battle of Britain Flight Lancaster on. They'd just done a major overhaul of that. And, of course, with them having the contract to maintain 790 going forward, so there was always that bit of experience there within their company. So it's been relatively easy to maintain that level of personnel up until at least the last 8 to 10 years. The main problem is that the Shackleton personnel that knew the aircraft through its coastal period, certainly, are just aging. They're getting on in the years.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of the people that visit me now, you know, ex-Shack air crew and ground crew, mentally they're acute as ever. But the problem we have is that they can't get hands on.
Physically
they can't climb up 20-foot ladder to pull the spark plugs out of Griffin, much as they want to. Or climb over the top of the airplane to try and reattach things or change bulbs on the thing or even replace rivets. So that's where we younger guys come in and the new generation as such. And we're learning an awful lot of the aircraft.
So tell us a bit about the airframe itself. What sort of history did it have and why is it so special?
63 is the claim to fame she's got, I suppose, is that she's the highest hour Shackleton out there. It's the one that's done the most flying hours of the lot. She's done 15,483 flying hours in total. The next one nearer is just knocking on the door of 15,000 hours, and that's one of the two. That's on par for. So essentially, she's been pretty much everywhere in the world. When you look through the logbooks of the aircraft, you know, it's been all over from right the way across Africa. It's been through the States, Iceland, Greenland, all the way out into the Far East. I mean, his career spans the Mediterranean, the Indian Ocean, the Pacific, all over. You know, over a period from 1954 to 1991.
Right.
It's just one of those aircraft where it's overshadowed by its more legendary siblings, the Lancaster on one side, and then a couple of years after it was built in 1957, you got the conception of the Vulcan and its introduction to service. So the Shackleton kind of suffers as a type, which I think is unfair. You know, whenever you put them together, you'll always have the Lancaster, which is the legend. The Vulcan is the V-Force.
Yeah.
Which Shackleton soldiered on from right in the 50s, right the way through to 1991. It ended up as the last in-service frontline piston-engined aircraft, I believe.
And that's why we need to keep telling these stories of these aircraft, because otherwise they're getting lost. But the key thing about... you call it 6-3.
Should I call it 6-3? 963. They were the big red numbers on the back.
Okay.
Each one in 8 Squadron service, certainly, they just had the tail code on the back. So it's just too abbreviated.
Okay, I'll call her 6-3. Does she have a nickname?
She does have a nickname. Again, that's from her 8 Squadron service. And John Cubley wasn't very keen on it when I brought it up. They all got nicknames from the Magic Roundabout. And the Herbs, the TV series.
Okay.
And 6-3 was Ermintrude. Yep. Yeah.
Ermintrude, okay. Right, okay. Mm-hmm. So for those of younger years, that was wasn't it?
So it was the pink cow with
that's
the blue
the cow
hat.
With the flower the in its mouth. Yeah, that's right. Wow, tell it my age there. So rapidly moving on then, Richard. But the key thing that you folks managed to do is you managed to get it back in ground running condition.
We did.
Didn't you?
John spearheaded those efforts. Him and his original crew. They returned the aircraft from being a silent relic on the corner of the field and being picked over for spare parts. By the Coventry Classic Air Show in the year 2000, she'd been repainted into 38 Squadron colours with the X on the nose for X-ray.
Why was that, Richard? Why was it repainted?
She was chosen to be repainted into one of her own colour schemes from the past. She served with 5 squadrons over the years.
Yeah.
Started out with 224 in Gibraltar. That was the overall white traditional coastal command scheme and the one that she's representing now.
Yeah.
Then 210 Squadron, 38 Squadron, 205 with the Far East Air Force, and that was the end of a coastal career. She was then one of 12 airframes that got picked up to be converted to airborne early warning. But the reason really for the repaint into 38 Squadron colours, she was due a repaint because of the terrible state of the original plane, but 38 Squadron was the squadron that John Cubley served on that aircraft in. So him being the guy that was running the restoration at the time, he basically just took his pick and put her into the colours that he remembered the best in. That's when she was serving on Malta.
So you talk about John there. Have you had many of her previous crew and support staff come to see her and are involved in the ground running?
Many, many, many over the years. People have come who've been on Shackleton's as air crew and ground crew. Over the last few years, most of the ones that we've had helping us that are ex-crew have basically they've stopped attending. That's the best way I can put it. They keep up with what we're doing. We send regular updates out to them, but the physical aspects of it, they'll come down if we're running the engines or if we're taxiing the aircraft, as we have done in the past. So John was one of the guys. He was instrumental in it. He was the guy that went to Air Atlantic and got the bull by the horns and said, "We want to restore it." John roped in several other people who knew from before. Don Arnott, who was a ground crew on Shackleton's. He was the engines man. We've got Roger Wyatt, who's the electrician. Roger Jarman, he was another engines man. He came in on it. We had John Mepham, he was a flight engineer. He was on the Shackleton that came down at Culloden, the one that crashed on Culloden Moor. He was a regular visitor.
Blimey.
Yeah. John was always an interesting one because he would never – John Mepham, that is, not John Cudley. John was always an interesting one because he would never miss a run-up. He'd come down with his wife. He'd be stood there. He'd absolutely love it. He was always – giving us a tap on the shoulder, pointing things out that we'd maybe not noticed in the new generation. It was basically like having a – we used to joke and refer to him as our cat board, our categorization board. He was the guy that you had to be up to that kind of standard, you know, to make sure you ran the aircraft safely and didn't do anything stupid.
And what did he, Richard, what did he, what was his position?
He was his crew engineer position? John Methven was a flight engineer.
Right, okay.
So, of course, when you're running the engines up, he was the perfect person to have around, especially with the experience he got. But when you read about that one, you know, where they basically had a catastrophic engine fire on the number three engine, which is right outside the flight engineer's window, and the engine burned itself off the wing, took part of the tail unit with it, and the aircraft crash landed on Culloden Moor. Luckily, all the crew survived. They all got out. Fantastic piece of airmanship.
I bet there are lots of stories that these folks who came to see you have relayed to you. Give us a few of the anecdotes that they've shared with you.
We've had incidents where there's been talk of the chap that had massive electrical failure while it was over the Mediterranean. Everything went down. They lost basically all electrics throughout the aircraft as it boiled its batteries. And they were just basically flying on, hoping that none of the Griffin engines quit, because obviously the engines have got magnetos on them, so as long as they're switched on and the fuel's still supplied, it'll keep running. So they had to basically make the best of it that they could and make an emergency landing using the oxygen blowdown system at the nearest airport, and they managed to bring it in with no electrical systems working.
Wow.
We had some crew tell us about when they were in the Indian Ocean with 205 Squadron in the Far East. They were at Singapore way, and they were saying that they all got scrambled when the American space mission on Apollo 13 had its issue. So they weren't quite sure where it was going to smash down.
Right, of course.
6-3 was involved in that. They were told to fly to the prudent limit of endurance that they got. 6-3 lost an engine and limped into an airport on the edge of, I forget where, but basically she was on fumes. So they'd not got enough fuel in the tanks to be able to take her back to the plane. The great thing for me is we've held a number of reunions, Coastal Command reunions in the past at Coventry Airport, and it's great because you open the gate, you see everybody coming towards you, and there's all these old guys, and you can see them, and they've either got a wheelchair or a stick or somebody helping them towards the aircraft.
Yeah.
And then 30 seconds later, you take a look out the aircraft window, and they're all abandoned near the steps, and they're coming on the aircraft, and they're crewing in like they're going to take it for a flight when you...
So
it's fantastic. Yeah. So as soon as you step through that door, they basically shed 30 or 40 years, and all of a sudden they're eager again.
Yeah.
They want to have a go. So...
Oh, bless them. Bless them. And one of the things that we've heard from Ian and from others is that camaraderie ship. The crews were very, very close. That was one of the things
if you think
picked
about
up.
It, there were up to 10 crew in a Shackleton. So operating, and they would be operating for crazy amounts of time, especially in coastal command times. The longest shack mission I heard of was a proving mission. It was something like 24 hours, 13 minutes endurance to prove it could be done.
Blimey, how did they do that?
That's literally on the fuel the aircraft can carry. So I think it was a toss-up, I think, between the RAF and the South Africans. There was an unofficial competition to see who could get the most endurance out of the shack. But, yeah, it was a shade over 24 hours. I think both South African and RAF did it. But when you put 10 people together for that amount of time and you're doing that kind of thing, you know, 10 hours, 12 hours, 14 hours, regularly going out over the Atlantic looking for Russian trawlers, the spy trawlers or the submarines or anything like that. Yeah, you're going to get a close-knit group. And then, of course, if you're going on detachment, you throw the ground crews into it as well. Yeah, so you're going to get that camaraderie. And it is something that's still there. No matter where you go, even as guys like us coming to it in preservation, if you go to somewhere where Shackletons are, the 12 that or so airframes that are left, or you go to one of the Shackleton Association events, it's brilliant in the fact that you're welcome. The crews, the ground crews, they love that you are trying to keep one of their aircraft not only preserved but in live running condition. The fact that we've been able over the years to bring them back and let them look at their aircraft. As you've seen probably from the pictures of 6-3, she's wearing the white scheme now, at the moment. She's due a repaint again, but for the past few years, she's been wearing the white scheme. We did that to make the aircraft stand out because we were trying to get publicity for it when we were looking for funding to see whether we could put it back in the air again. So primarily it was done for that. No other Shackleton was in white, so we thought, why not? We'll put it in white. That way, whenever anybody says, okay, which one are you working on? The white one. And straight away it's identifiable.
Right.
What we didn't realize at the time was 963's very first service pilot was still around. He was still with us. Forgive me, I've missed his name. So
it's okay. Don't worry.
Mitchell.
Don't worry.
John Mitchell. I've got it. And,
okay. Wow. Well done. Basically, well done.
He started as World War II air crew and then remustered onto Shackleton's post-war. But he was the guy that picked 963 up from the UK and took her onto a first service squadron, 224 squadron at Gibraltar. So he basically picked her up brand new from the factory.
Wow.
When we found out that he was still with us, we invited him down to Coventry Airport to see the aircraft. And he was absolutely fascinated and absolutely overjoyed. Because as soon as he came through the gate, he saw the aircraft sitting on the grass there in the correct colours with the correct lettering on the nose. And he was ecstatic. He said, there's my Shackleton. Straight away. He knew it. And he got the logbook out. And sure enough, he'd taken her all up. He'd taken her not only out to 224 Squadron to serve in Gibraltar, but he'd taken her all around the Mediterranean for up until 1957 when she left 224 Squadron.
Yeah, because as you mentioned, they served in warmer climes as well as, you know, the North Atlantic. So they got to get all the way around the world. And you mentioned South Africa there. They had Shackletons
they did,
as well,
South
didn't
African
they?
Air Force looked for a replacement for some aging aircraft that they got. And they picked the Shackleton and they had a batch of 8 aircraft supplied by Avro to their own specification. And they successfully flew them well into the 1980s and then managed to retain one aircraft in flying condition right away to 2009.
Wow. So Richard, she was in ground running condition. She was in engine running condition. She was in ground running condition. What did it take to keep that aircraft going, you know, fuel, crew, maintenance,
it takes
space.
A massive effort. When we were doing ground runs, when we were doing just a static engine run, you'd be looking about a month of preparation to get through everything for a run-up that you'd be doing once a month. So to get, because of the numbers of people that we've got, the amount of aircraft that we've got to get through, to check everything over, make sure everything works, do all the checks, all by the book, with the, you take nearly a month because we're all working around regular jobs. We're working, you know, weekends, evenings, if we can grab them for the guys that are closer. And the amount of man hours taken to do what you can, any snags that you found from the previous run-ups, all the before flight, after flight stuff, you'd just be talking basically a month for a run-up. You know, you're looking at four week preparation. In terms of fuel costs, you're talking, she'll burn roughly a gallon per minute per engine at the power settings that we use when we're doing a ground run. That's roughly in today's cost, you're looking about £8 or £9 per engine per minute. So it's a significant amount of fuel cost. Oil is more difficult to manage. The Griffin's got a thirst for oil, but it's not something that we'd see with the amount of hours that we run until we get, say, 6 months, and then we dip the tanks and change again, unless we notice a visible leak or something like that. But in terms of other stuff like spares, continually hunting for spares and making sure that we've got the kit to be able to look after the aircraft. So hydraulic spares, propeller parts, electrical spares, in particular contactors and relays and things like that, because a lot of the stuff's not made anymore. And the places that will overhaul it are long since gone. Whereas wartime aircraft, you mainly rely on a mechanical lever that operates a control, be it by a teleflex cable or be it by a control rod. And in the 50s, you started looking at electronic actuators and control units that were moved by way of, you'd flick a switch and an electrical circuit would close and a motor would operate a valve or something instead. So you were starting looking into that kind of area. So the shacks, it's very much on the borderline. So some systems are relatively easy to repair. Some systems are terrible, especially when you encounter things that have got valves in.
Yeah. So where do you get your parts everywhere from? I mean, are some of those old shacks still sitting around all around the world, or have you got a good source? How do you do it, Richard?
Because obviously there's only 12 Shackletons left. There's probably going to be a couple less in upcoming years, because the rate of attrition, a lot of them are sat outside. Some of them are derelict. The two on Cyprus that I mentioned, they've been derelict since 1994. So the chap that bought those two at the auction, he ran out of funding and they've sat there ever since. So we're probably going to lose those two. But the people that have got Shackletons, they're very reluctant to let you go pillage. So you have to be very careful.
Yeah.
Sometimes, I will stress it is sometimes, offer to swap component. If you've got an unserviceable component, but it's a complete component, you can offer to swap for a serviceable component of an aircraft that's no longer live. Some museums and some collections will let you do that, some won't. The other side of the coin is just basically trading and trying to find what you can on eBay from Warbird parts dealers. For instance, the back end of 2023, we got offered some propeller spares, and they're out in California. So it's all around the world, right, and it's just picking up what you can and when you can. It's also.
So how do you guys fund all
that's
of
kind
that?
Of what it was leading on to me onto next. It's basically we have to play very carefully with the budget that we've got. We have a very finite amount of funding. We raised it primarily through limited sales of merchandise through Airbase or Classic Air Force as they were when they were still running. Through the website, you could donate at the time. We've still got the Facebook page up. And also, we made use of the aircraft. We tried to make 6-3 pay for herself. What we'd do is during an engine run-up, you could buy a place on board the aircraft in a seat, anywhere up to the co-pilot's seat.
Right, okay.
And you could be in the aircraft during the engine run-up. We'd also do photography events where, for instance, we'd do a night run once a year.
Yeah.
Where we'd run the aircraft in the dark at night, so you get the spectacle of all the navigation lights, the interior lighting with the dim red glow, and then of course you get the massive and fantastic exhaust flames off the four Rolls-Royce Griffins.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so that keeps it going, but unfortunately, in the last few years, there's been some changes.
There has.
That weren't related to the aircraft, but affect how it's going to be, where it's going to be, and what the future lies. Tell us what happened. Where did that come from?
The beginning of things was when Air Atlantic, the owner of Air Atlantic Classic Flight, Mike Collett, decided to retire. And he put the collection that he had at Coventry Airport and at St. Morgan up for sale. And the collection got sold off piece by piece. It kind of left 963, the Shackleton, it left her and the Nimrod as orphan aircraft because they were unairworthy and they were too big to move. The Shackleton had already been signed over back to the Trust by Classic Air Force and Classic Flight, as they were. The Nimrod subsequently became ours the same way, and we passed it on to another group to look after independently because it was too big a burden on our finances to sustain that. After Classic Air Force had left and Classic Flight had gone and Mike had retired, we managed to keep things going for a number of years further, But then we got dealt a second blow, which was Coventry Airport got slated for redevelopment, and they wanted to build, and still want to build, a battery gigafactory on the airfield. So that will obliterate Coventry Airport. Coventry Airport will effectively cease to exist once that is built. So,
So ergo, where do you run a Shackleton? Well,
that presents a problem future. Because if you have an airworthy aircraft, there are plenty of options on the table. You can move the aircraft around. You can move it from airfield to airfield as the rents and rates suit you. You know, so long as there's avgas and somewhere to park it, you're pretty much in business. However, we were a preservation group with a single aircraft, and it made life rather more difficult. So the criteria was we had to find somewhere that would take a large aircraft, be able to keep it in a running condition, and guarantee its safety for a number of years into the future. We didn't want to be moving the aircraft and then find out 3 or 4 years down the line that we've got to do it all again. It'd be a massive waste of time and resources.
And although she was running, Richard,
we actually tried to get her airworthy again. Initially, the feasibility study put it between £3 and £5 million to see it done. We pushed as hard as we could down the line with the Civil Aviation Authority to get the type approved for flight. We managed to get the aircraft civil registered, so it's still on the civil register. We also managed to get Shackleton as a type approved for a permit to fly. So should anybody ever have a burning desire to put Shackleton back in the air again in the UK, there is a route and there is a way to do that. Shackleton as a type now can be approved for a permit to fly, so long as that the aircraft is rebuilt to an airworthy condition. So the stumbling block that was put in place in 1991, which was British Aerospace insisting that the type was life expired as a whole, is now gone. In fact, if you rebuild your Shackleton to an approved condition, you can fly it. It's just a matter of finances. But £3 to £5 million, we thought, was doable. If we could find a decent investor, we could get a long way down that path. And we pushed as far as we could. By 2015, we got the aircraft taxi into a condition where we could take her down the runway at Coventry Airport and go up quite a lick. She'd done it once where we'd had the tail up. But that was a couple of years prior to that. 2015 was about the closest we ever got. A few years after that, we had COVID. So we got down the path a little ways further, and then COVID impacted us. We couldn't go near the aircraft for approximately 18 months. We lost 18 months on that. The rules for COVID said that if it was an airworthy aircraft, you could do essential maintenance. Unfortunately, not being an airworthy aircraft, we weren't deemed to be essential work, so we had to stay away. So we came back post-COVID to a very grubby-looking, very grumpy aircraft, and that made life difficult. So undaunted, we went away, did the feasibility study again to see how much ground we'd lost, and the feasibility study put it closer to, well, it put it between 5 and 10 million. To see it done, with the increase in costs due to inflation, various other factors, and that put it beyond reach, to be honest. When you started going around investors that are into warbirds, and you tell them that, you know, hey, you could help us get this Shackleton flying, it'd be something nobody's done, they go away, do their sums, they talk to their accountant, say they've got a burning desire to fly an aircraft, you know, a historic aircraft, and the accountant would go, well, hang on a minute, how much is it going to cost? 10 million. Okay, yeah. Well, you are aware you can buy 3 Spitfires for that, and that would be the end of the conversation.
Yeah, understood.
So, sadly for us, that was the end of the road. We've taken the decision, the reluctant decision, you know, to preserve the aircraft in a running condition for as long as we can. And that leads back around to looking for a new home for the aircraft, which we set to doing in 2021. Late 2021, early 2022. The criteria that we set for the new home, I've touched on previously, it had to be somewhere that would preserve it. It had to be somewhere that would allow running. That narrowed it down to a handful of places within the UK. Bruntingthorpe was one at the time. unfortunately, that got bought out by Cox Automotive, and they moved virtually everything off-site.
Yeah. But yeah, it dodged air.
East Kirby was another, because of the excellent work that they've done with their Lancaster, the recent acquisition of the Mosquito, the B25 that we've got, and now the Bolingbroke as well. Unfortunately, with Sixth Street, she falls just outside their collecting policy in that she's a post-war aircraft as opposed to a wartime aircraft. But the guys at East Kirby have been unfailing in support to help us move, and they also offered a parking space should we need it if things got really down to the wire, which I really do appreciate.
Oh, that was good.
The last place that we looked, and the one that I favoured through some previous volunteer work I'd done, was Yorkshire Air Museum, Elvington. And throughout the history of the museum, they're a relatively new museum. I think they were set up something like 1997, 98. But they've rapidly expanded into a world-class museum, and they've got a lot of really good Cold War exhibits. And 6-3 would effectively fit in there like a missing piece of a jigsaw puzzle. They also carry out regular what they call Thunder Days, where anything that they've got that they can run engines on, they do run up to prove that it's live. They're very proud of the fact that a lot of their exhibits are live. And they're actually working at returning more and more of their aircraft collection to a running status, which is fantastic. So we had a few meetings with their board of trustees and the directors, and we came to an agreement whereby we would move WR963. Would start at the end of 2023, and we would dismantle the aircraft and move it to Yorkshire Air Museum at Elvington.
Okay, where do we start with this then, Richard? How does one go about taking apart an aircraft that predominantly most of the people now working on it had never been qualified or engineered to do that? Where do you start? What do you do?
It was a heck of a task. So first off, we had a look, and there have been a couple of Shackleton moves carried out relatively recently. The one of the Shackletons that was a Gatwick machine, it had been moved to Bruntingthorpe and then got caught up in the saga with Cox, and it was moved to St Athan. Another Shackleton had moved relatively recently from the Manchester Science Museum to its spiritual home at Woodford. So it's that's gone back home.
Okay.
So we got a few pointers from the guys that had done that. The issue for us was we were doing something slightly different in that we were taking a running aircraft and we were going to try and make it run again at the other end. The other side of things as well for us was that our aircraft was rebuilt in 1970 as an airborne early warning aircraft. And what we didn't realize at the time when we started this dismantling is that a lot of the work done to it to do that was only ever intended to be temporary. So things like the wiring looms that were put in for the airborne early warning radar system, they were all a one-piece loom. They were put into the system was put into the aircraft and it was wired in situ. So there are no breaks in it. There are no cable breaks between the sections.
Right. Yeah. Okay, I understand. So it's not an unplug and take
the original,
out.
The original wiring unplugs at various sections and you can feed it back through the airborne early warning systems and all the gubbins that run it, the alternators out of the back of each engine that supply the AC voltage to the radar. Everything is basically, it's hardwired. It travels from point A to point B through various sections of airframe. So that in itself presented a problem. It's still an ongoing headache at the moment during the dismantling work.
What do you do in that instance, Richard? I mean, obviously you've got to disconnect it to move the aircraft, but is it a cut and splice or is it a rewire when you get there?
In a perfect world, how's that gonna work? It would be basically you'd rewire it at the other end. In reality, we don't have the time, and we don't have the people with the skills at the moment to be able to do that. So what we can do is we can find certain sections within the airframe where the wiring passes through, where it'll never be seen again. And we're basically cutting and tagging, and we'll resplice everything at the other end. The radar system doesn't strictly have to work, but it would be nice not to have bundles of cut wires everywhere. So what we can reconnect, we will. In terms of...
Did did any of that equipment on board actually function in any basic or simple way?
Up until we shut the aircraft down in September 2023, other than the scanner being dropped out of the aircraft, the actual from the radome underneath, all the equipment that was in the aircraft was functional. She was a functioning aircraft from stem to stern.
That's quite amazing, actually. So, Richard, for an XMOD aircraft, normally
The radios had had a slight upgrade to cope with the frequency spacings because the CAA had changed things over the years from 25 kilohertz to 8.33. So we kept up with that with an eye to what we were doing towards flying the aircraft. But in terms of everything else, be it the Orange Harvest spark plug on the top, looking at the catching any radar looking away, it all worked. That was the beauty of it. You could bring up all the systems, you could fire everything up, all the inverters inside, and the equipment would come alive. And that was part of the beauty of it. Right. She was a functional aircraft. So.
Wow, very unusual for an aircraft.
Yeah, she wasn't
that age.
Other than taking some of the more sensitive equipment that she got, I think it was a couple of the IFF sets that they took away when she landed. Everything else was left intact. We still got the 1991 Air Almanac in there, the map that she flew in with when they brought her across from RF Waddington post auction. We'd still got the last logbook snap list. There was a little diary in one of the cupboards next to one of the radar operator's desks, and it got all the list of snags and how the radar was performing on the last missions that she'd done out of the North Sea. Radar won't lock on a heading and he's looking at, this won't fire up, this won't fire up, this contactor keeps dropping out. Various things. I think there was one complaint that the... one of the galley fuses had blown. It was suspected that the contactor had welded on, but they were most displeased that the galley was non-functional, which you can understand.
Yeah, I bet they were. I bet no honker stew.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Richard, where's the... I don't know quite how to describe it. Where's the dismantlement? What stage are you at now? I've been watching... closely to the activity. It doesn't feel comfortable.
the areas that we work on most have proved the easiest bits to do. That's the simple way of putting it. So obviously the engines and propellers have had an awful lot of attention over the years, and they came off relatively easy. So we defueled, de-oiled the aircraft, got rid of, emptied all the systems out. Then we got the propeller kit and the engine lifting slings and removed the power planks and propellers. We've removed the tail fins. We had the lifting slings for the tail fins. We've taken the aircraft off its wheels and dropped her down by 3 to 4 feet. So it's a multiple stage process where once the outer wings are off, she'll then go on her belly and the fuselage will get split. If we have low winds and a good amount of luck, then this Saturday, 27th, the outboard wings will be coming off the aircraft. Then we'll just be left with a center section from the fuselage to split.
Right. And for anyone, I know we're going to put some links and talk about the links in later, but if anyone wants to watch this, your Facebook page has pretty much got a running commentary on this at the moment.
Our Facebook page is Avro Shackleton, and if you look on there, we update regularly. We've been trying to hold off with the updates over the past week or so because a lot of it is, here's another panel with 300 screws in that we've got to drill out, whereas when you see an engine coming off or a tail fin coming off, it's a little bit more exciting.
Yeah, something big, isn't it? Big steps.
The reality of it is an awful lot of the work is drilling rivets and screws out. We've got an aircraft that's well over 60 years old, and it's been sat outside in all weathers for the past 33 years, and it's putting up an awful fight. We're getting into sections of the aircraft that haven't seen the light of day now since. The last data tag I found on it when I was down there last week was 1967. We uncovered a lot of PALs and all the data tags in 1967. So we're into its coastal command era when this section was last taken apart.
So when is the plan, when's the estimate that she'll be fully unassembled and ready to transport.
If everything goes to plan and we can get her apart, is we're looking at mid to late September. That's the date right. that we're hoping for. It was hoped that the majority of the aircraft will be up at Elvington now, but unfortunately bad weather and high winds at the beginning of the year put paid to a lot of the work that we wanted to do.
Yeah, and are you shipping elements of it as you go, or is it one big?
We'll get the aircraft dismantled. We'll get everything in transport stillages, load it up, and it'll go over the space of about a week or so.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
Then I'm not going to put you on the spot, but roughly what do you think it will take to put her back together again? When would we potentially be able to see her ground running?
I'd say if everything went well and we could find everything we needed and remedy everything, that's 18 months to 2 years. Realistically.
Right.
I know
okay.
people want to hear, okay. oh, yeah, it'll be a couple of months and it'll be stood there and engines will be back on again. But it's not yeah. the case. We've had to drill too many screws and rivets out. So there's an awful lot of work involved in that. And it is real tedious grunt work where you're going to be drilling the remains of a screw out. You're going to be putting a tap in there to reinstate the thread. Or at the worst case, you're going to be replacing anchor nuts and things like that. But there's an awful lot of work to be done. We've yeah. also found areas of corrosion as well that we want to address, stuff that we wouldn't have found unless we were dismantling the aircraft to this level. So with an eye to the future, it makes sense to get that rectified now while we can see it.
Get it right.
Preserve it and yeah. then put it back together, yeah. ensuring that she stays in good condition yeah. for a long time into the future. I mean, my little
right, lad okay.
sees the aircraft. He loves it. I want his little lad to see it and love it. I want it to be there that long and running the
yeah.
same and exciting people the same way.
Now, you might have sold some T-shirts and some mugs, but that's not going to fund dismantling, assembling, transporting, rebuilding. How are you going about supporting this move?
We used up a lot of the funding that we got in reserve. I'll admit that because as I said to you, with the bad weather at the beginning of the year, things ran over. We do have a significant amount of bills to pay in terms that we pay commercial rents at the airport to be there. And now the aircraft's down, we've not really got the income that we did before. So a lot of it has been through donations and also through a rather successful GoFundMe campaign that we've had running online. A lot of the funding has come from that.
Okay. And how can people support you through that?
Go to GoFundMe, which is a very good website online for charitable causes, and you look for WR963 Avro Shackleton Move to Elvington. We're on there. You'll be able to find us. It's a now, big picture of a big white airplane, and we'd love any help we can get.
Now, you're not asking no. for millions for this. It's not a massive amount. So you're really looking for anything people can share, you know, pounds, shillings, pence,
yeah,
dollars, euros.
We asked initially on the GoFundMe, they ask you to set an arbitrary target. We did that. We set it at £12,000 and it was achieved just after Christmas. We're currently on just over £15,000.
Right. But the ambition, I think, is nearer to
yeah,
25, isn't it? Something like that.
25. So, you know, the closer we get to that figure, the easier it becomes. So,
yeah, yeah. And we'll put links to that in the show notes so people can go there and hopefully donate a pound or two to help towards this. But, Richard, where else can we find out about you and what the team's doing on the internet and on social media?
There's a couple of old aviation forums that we used to post on. So if you're looking at the backstory, you can look at those. They're the Key Publishing Historic Aircraft Forum. And also on UK Aviation Review, we had a thread on there running for a long time. More recently, we moved on to Facebook. We found we've got better engagement with the subject audience that we have on Facebook. So if you look for us at Avro Shackleton on Facebook, and you will find us straight away. As I said, for the moment, we're the big white ones, so we're fairly easy to spot.
Right, and we'll put those links in the show notes along with this program as well. Richard, all that remains is for everyone here, and I'm sure everyone listening to this, to wish you every success in dismantling, transporting, reassembling, and getting growler running again. Okay, in our next chapter, we turn our attention towards the Shackleton replacement through the eyes of Chris Gibson and his brilliant book, Nimrod's Genesis. We'd like to thank White Hearts for our music and the Aviation Historian for their support. You can find me, Peter Johnson, at Nascot Hornet on Twitter X, and the extended team can be found across most social media portals. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Richard.
Nice goodbye from Peter.
And it is goodbye from Peter. Stay tuned to hear our next chapter of the Cold War Coastal Command story on Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.